Hello, I'm Somi Aryan. I'm the founder of the think tank for women in business and technology and the FemPeak platform with the mission of raising women's socioeconomic status. In 2019, I was writing a book about the future of work when I looked at my references and realized that most of them were male. Not just that, I could also see that the majority of jobs that were going to disappear as a result of technological advancements were those of women's. So when the book came out in 2020, I started a movement to encourage more women to develop their skills in business and technology, and this podcast is part of that movement. Our guest today is Joshua Meredith, who is the Director of Career Advising and Technology at Yeshiva University. He also teaches ethics at Yeshiva, Georgetown University, and Muhlenberg College, in addition to being the chair of Hoya Hacks, the Georgetown University Hackathon. Joshua has a special interest in technology education and helping women achieve equality. He was a guest speaker at our second conference for women in business and technology. So here's my conversation with Joshua Meredith. When you were on the conference, I wanted to have a male voice closing, and I knew that your points were very relevant to the impact of men and why it is important to have more men, you know, being engaged in the conversation on why we need to have women in technology. Let's start with that. You know, let's just talk about why is it important for men to care about this? Is it, you know, is this when we talk about women's issues or women in leadership or women in technology, there's been many times when we invited people, they're like, they just respond saying, even though the email says that we want to have men on the panel and we want to have men in the movement, they just respond saying, I'm not a woman. I'd like to hear your views and your attitude on that.
Especially here in the United States, where I'm based, it's incredibly important for us, for men to be not only allies of women who are sort of growing their acumen in terms of the business field and technology, growing into larger roles, but it's important for us to be part of the development as well. If you look at the United States workforce, the majority now of employees is women, but we haven't seen that in what would be traditional large business and technology roles. What, you know, there has always been in the United States a crafted and set of roles, which I think of are unfairly sort of labeled as pink sort of collar roles. And I always think that that is something that we can really improve upon. It's the purpose of education, where I spend the majority of my time, to really look at the entire landscape and really provide for not just the males in our classes, but the females as well, and really trying to help a group that at times has not been the focus. So when someone like yourself invites me to a panel, or there's the opportunity for us to speak in this regard, I think it's important that more men actually get involved. When you look at sort of human resources departments as a whole, they are, for the most part, there are more women in human resources. There are more women in the society for human resources professionals, right? Sure. That should allow for women to be really part of the development process. And it's for the men who may have some of the more senior roles, either at companies in human resources departments or in education, to really help build that acumen and to really sort of grow what we're trying to do. And I think that's an important piece of what men need to start to understand. I think if you look at sort of large technology companies, we're still in the 60s to 70s% men, right? Across the board, without even talking about leadership type positions. If you look at entrepreneurship, it's dominated by men. And I think that those kinds of conversations are ones that we need to just not look at from how can we grow the number of female entrepreneurs? It's a broader conversation about how we educate, how we grow it from a baseline perspective.
Yeah, definitely. So one question is, like, how can we get more women interested in entrepreneurship and in technology? And because I'm finding, I think a lot of women, they like the idea of it, but it is very hard. And of course, especially with the fact that women often have children and things like that, you know, I think it's really fundamentally important for society to have more women or female perspective in these areas and to have more women in the top tier. Because when I look at, you know, the world is run by 10 corporations, you know, right? 5 in the US and 5 in China. And they're all run by men. There is no female perspective in the top tier, right? Like you have to go a good few tiers down to start to see women, you know, but at that level, we don't have, you know, like if we, and that's just looking at the top 10 corporations, you know, even if we look at top 100 corporations, there's still like not as many women, right? And not nowhere near an equal number, or even like not even 10%, not even 5%, I believe it's like much smaller than that. And especially when you're talking about entrepreneurial ones, right? So the ones where like you're talking about the kinds of Jeff Bezos and you know, Bill Gates, where I'm not talking about HSBC appointing a woman, right? I'm talking about how can we get female Zuckerbergs and female Jeff Bezos, you know, that level of impact. Elon Musk, you know, that type of thing. So what, in your opinion, from years of working with advising, you know, women in technology, in students getting into these fields. You know, I also wrote a book on the future of work, and I have my own kind of views on this, but I would be really interested to hear from your experience, what is holding women back?
You know, I think that this is a multifactorial sort of situation, right? I think if you look at how the development of sort of education, and then education then going to the collegiate level, and then the collegiate level leading into whatever work looks like. I think that when we discuss this, we have to really look at a bunch of different things, right? So the first thing is that the companies, if you look at three of the largest companies in the United States, they did not exist in some form 20 years ago, right? Or they were very, very small startups. And now they're the largest companies sort of in America. So obviously entrepreneurship is one thing that we have to encourage female leaders to really get into, right? Because the companies that may lead America 20 years from now potentially don't exist. And that's something I think we really need to take into consideration. That's, I think, a very important piece of what we're working on. I also think, you know, one of the things that I found, and I spent some time while I was at Georgetown working with Girls Who Code, which is an organization which really takes high school girls and really teaches them to code so that they can enter the technology field. And I think, you know, one thing that I really learned from both their research and also just looking at it across the board is by the time a young woman gets to college, her ability to get into the technical fields, she may already be behind, I wouldn't say the eight ball, but a little bit behind the learning curve. What we need to do is we actually need to empower girls, right? During
so why do you think? Sorry to interrupt. So why is it that they are already behind?
Because I think that they're either the boys have either learned some form of coding language previously, or they've been educated that whatever they haven't learned, they're going to be able to learn quickly. And I don't know that we do the same for college age women. That I think is something. So we need to get to the situation earlier, right? Empowerment at a younger age, I think, will quite help, right? That's not something we often think about. You know, we're encouraging women and young girls to really grow in many areas. I think the concepts of entrepreneurship, coding, on business skills is clearly a frontier of which we're working to build, but I don't know that it's occurring now. The next thing that we have to think about is, you know, one of the things that I often talk to advisees at a college level and even a post-college level is you can't always go to the Fortune 500 company with the good benefits, right? There's a certain element of risk-taking that occurs by going to a smaller startup or starting your own business that we often have not encouraged due to the benefit levels of the Fortune 500 companies, either in technology, consulting, or traditional banking, which, you know, have cornered the market on a lot of talent. Right. You know, you often see that students at an MBA level. Right. There has been a huge trend for MBA programs to really grow their entrepreneurship wings. And now there's a whole set of rankings and students often pick now their MBA programs based on entrepreneurship. But you look at that, those students may be mid-20s, late 20s, early 30s by the time they get to that stage. So you're talking about a big gap where, yes, there's experience learned by potentially going and working at a large scale financial institution or going to work at a large scale sort of business as a whole. But that entrepreneurship mindset, I don't know that necessarily gets in at the college level. And that's something that we can clearly improve. And I think that we are working to improve it. I think that there has to be the sort of the willingness to take risks. I think one of the things that you see now is, you know, there has to be funds appropriated with that. You can't just ask a 22-year-old, a 23-year-old to sort of go out on their own without any sort of financial backing. So that's something that we're, you know, I think business can help facilitate on some level.
Yeah. Yeah. Especially, you know, I was talking to Justine, who was on the previous, she was a managing director of Marie Claire, and she was on the previous panel, and she was telling me about how men, especially white men, have got these networks of people who, you know, once you get into that kind of entrepreneurial environment, they have these networks of people that will help them. Whereas I definitely feel that as a woman, you don't have that network, you know. But what I've done is that I've created my own network, you know. So I've taken huge amount of risk to do that. And I every penny that I earn from my marketing agency, I put into building this new business, and that is taking a level of risk. And I just feel like, if you don't have the network, you create the network. But then it does take a toll on relationships, on family. You know, it is a lot of work, and it's incredibly difficult. But I think that part of this comes back to the male-female roles, because I think it's a lot more accepted in society when a man chooses to go after, you know, a career goal at any cost. Usually the woman that they're with, they support them. They say that behind every great man, there is a great woman. I don't know if that's the case the other way. You know, it's not been my experience. And I think that it's a lot harder for men to support women when they go after these kinds of, you know, audacious goals. It's been definitely from my observation and experience. And actually, this whole movement came out of breakup for me, because, you know, I was like, you know, I was in a relationship that, for 5 years, and I was, you know, very much in love with my partner, but I felt that I was put in a position that I had to choose between, you know, career and relationship. And that was despite the fact that I had made the sacrifice or you know, decision to not have kids, you know, so even that did not necessarily help. So I think that part of this comes back to how can we, going through education, you know, how can we change from early days of education when we get to school, how can we change the way that we treat men and women or young boys and girls, you know, to be supportive, like actually actively getting little boys to support little girls in those areas, you know, because they do learn differently, they think differently, and I think that it goes back to that. But I don't really know whether we can do that quickly enough or at a large enough scale to see a difference, considering a meaningful difference, considering how fast technology is growing.
You know, let's talk about a couple of different pieces in this. You know, one of the things that in sort of my research and working with some master's students is that I found is that you're talking about women, not just in the workplace, but in terms of management, upper management, and really the levels that we need to get at, right, which is CEOs, founders, of large scale business, this is a slow rising build, right? So this is not something that is occurring overnight. It's going to take us decades, I think, to get there, right? You're essentially looking at women outside of the what we would consider the traditional workforce globally, right? Until after post-World War II, right? Other than just sort of like in a township or local vicinage. You know, so this is something that's growing, I think, if you look from about 1970 forward. So you were at the 50-year mark now on what we would consider sort of business growth. When you, I think, look at that in the totality of sort of business history, right, from the 1700s forward, I really think that, you know, I think we are, and one of the things I want to impress upon is that we are moving quickly, right, and that we are making progress. And I one of the things we have to continue to work on is the male mindset when it comes to this. It's something we've done, we just have not done well enough in. And I think that that piece potentially comes with almost retraining how the male brain thinks about women in the workplace, which is not an easy thing to do. And is something that we need to spend more time on. We need to spend more time on the study of it. We need to spend more time in the teaching of it. And we need to spend more time really working towards that level of equality. Because I'm going to be honest, we're not there yet.
Yeah. So when you say about how men think about women in the workplace, can you break that down a little bit? What in your observation sure. has been that? How do men think about women in the workplace? It would be very interesting for me to hear it from a male perspective, because I have my own experiences. But I'd like to see whether that kind of...
So if we look from a historical perspective, right? So if we think about the 1980s and 1990s, because of the number of men, and let's just talk about this in industries that have existed for a long time, finance, banking, and then maybe some small technology companies that have now grown into some large ones. There weren't many women at these companies, right? I think if you probably looked and if you talked to some women from those days, which a lot of social scientists has, they were tokenized on some level. Right. And men thought of them as that token. Now that we're trying to build more equality, men need to think about women as an equal. Right. And in the workplace. And I think that is part of what is growing. If you look at a company, and I'm just going to use Google as an example. Right. For all of the diversity efforts that they put forward. Right. Their coding business, which is the heart of what they do, is still at least 60% male in most sectors. Okay, so that means women are not thought of as potentially equals. And there need to be some removal of some stigmas, I think, as well, just from the perspective that we just haven't thought about equality in that way. You know, when I talk about we need to think differently, it's partially because we are looking at this from an old school model of, well, women will earn their worth, right? Women will show that they're equal in terms of the work. And I don't know that that's necessarily going to happen, at least in the short term, maybe in the long term. But we need to teach boys, young men, and men that women have the same abilities without them having to prove it day after day after day. You know, that is something that you hear from a number of women in the workplace. I constantly feel the need to prove myself. Well, and sure, we want, obviously, every business wants production. Right. But that doesn't mean and I think where I struggle with the concept of is this ethical or not, the concept that women can only prove their worth through, you know, showing it on a day to day basis is a real struggle, I think, in the workplace. And if you think about that from a male perspective, that's not necessarily going to lead us to the best possible place. You know, one of the things I often see is it's a female owned business with mostly female employees. Right. And I think I get that mindset because, you know, essentially cordoning women off into smaller subset groups in terms of companies can potentially be very valuable in this case, because there isn't that sort of stigma in the room.
Yeah, definitely. That's what I do. You know, I have a team of five people. Four of them are women, and especially as a filmmaker, you know, it's like our industry is so male dominated. So we just did a film in Germany for our biggest client is Steinway Pianos. So you know, they're very prestigious, the best, you know, pianos in the world. And when I came back, I was talking to the team in Germany, and they were like, so what did you do about cameraman? I was like, no, I just went with Elizabeth. And they were like, what? Elizabeth was your cameraman? I said, well, I operate the camera. Elizabeth we did it together, you know, and Elizabeth is a 23-year-old, and we went together with a, you know, with like DSLRs, and we actually created a beautiful film, you know. But I know that if I don't give that opportunity to my team, if they go into other production companies, they're not going to get that opportunity at that age. They will be like, you know, just because they're, you know, they will be asked to do work as a runner for so long, whereas I push them to already really behave like and actually deliver like a producer, you know, and not just a runner assistant. So I think that having more female operated businesses, hiring more females, that's definitely something that's very helpful. I'm finding it quite hard now as I'm trying to hire coders, you know, for this business. You know, I'm finding it quite hard to find enough female coders that are at that level, especially, you know, a lot of them are just starting out, you know, but then you think, okay, I'm going to invest in getting this person to a level, and then obviously there's a good chance that we'll get poached by a Google or whatever, you know. Yeah, so that there's not a big enough pool of women getting into these. So my other thought was maybe to hire women who are not coders and then put them through training, but that's also a very lengthy and difficult process, and without getting some kind of funds and you know, sponsorship for that, it's quite difficult to achieve that. So I mean, I don't know what exactly the solution is, but on the other hand, other than the fact that we just need more women to step up, you know, and I do feel that as a woman, I always feel like if I'm on a panel, I have to be triple smarter than everybody else and like well-read and everything, because people look at you and like they have an expectation and
especially when you potentially are the only woman on the panel, right?
Yeah, which is often the case.
If you're the only woman on the panel, that pressure, the pressure quotient goes up so much. And, you know, I think that there's a real ethical problem with that in itself. And that is a real struggle. You know, as someone who studies business ethics, I think it's really the pressure that we put on women to perform, especially when they're in male-dominated situations. I think it'd have a real deep psychological effect as well. It is, our companies can do a much better job handling that situation. And I don't know that we always do. So that's a place where there's real need for development, and that we need to be stronger in terms of leadership on that.
So I'm assuming that you advise companies on ethics of workplace and ethics of technology. So tell me a little bit about your experience with that.
You know, I mostly work to advise students at a master's level. So they're at junior management or middle management levels, and I'm trying to grow them into senior leaders. So I'm doing it more through direct students. I've been teaching at Georgetown for about 5 years in a master's of professional studies in human resources program. And one of the things that we really talk about is, you know, how do we, the course is called Workplace Ethics, and how do we sort of grow our ethicality in terms of our businesses? And I think that what I really try to impress upon, oftentimes businesses make decisions without critical thinking, without really critical analysis. And that's a really big struggle point. Also, there is a ton of short-term thinking at every major business. And that's mostly because of the model that we've created in terms of profits, which is a real struggle for someone who has to sort of provide analysis skills while a student may be trying to make a bottom line at the end of a quarter. And I think that is a place, if you look at sort of where unethical actions happen in the business, when things move too quickly, when a wrong decision is made, that is often sort of the precipice around that. I think the weight of financial pressure often makes unethical action happen faster. And that's really something that we need to that we can continue to improve on, but it only can occur if everyone's on board with a different way of thinking.
Can you give me some examples of those unethical actions without mentioning any company names, just so people get a better idea of what kind of situations you're mentioning?
Sure. I think anything from yank and rank policies on how employees are just chosen, who moves on, who becomes management. We're often just looking at sales numbers and quotas. We often, when I think about real unethical actions, we're talking about businesses who are somehow moving the bottom line in a way that they shouldn't. I also think, how about unnecessary levels of risk, right? Especially in the finance industry, where traders have been given the ability to really make trades in a way that they shouldn't, ways that would affect their clients. I think when you think back a decade plus now to everything that happened up until 2007, 2008 in our last financial crisis, which happened globally on some level, you look at all of the things that occurred in terms of the creation of both the financial products and then the backing that went into them, right? One of the things that I often hear about is, well, Wall Street made mistakes when in terms of 2007. But look at all the companies who underwrote what they did, signed off on what they did. This wasn't just one business. It wasn't one set of an industry. A lot of that stuff happens because we've lost some of the ability to do that critical analysis because we are trying to build our profits to so high. When I talk to people who are in the client service world, in terms of finance or business or technology, one of the things we really talk about is what is the best interest of your client in relation to your best interest as a business. Short-term thinking, I think, really hurts us on that level.
Yeah, definitely. So, and that was part of what we were talking about in this conference, because I was saying that is this short-term thinking very much a male-oriented thinking? Is it true that it was just like a hypothetical kind of asking whether this is the case, that maybe if we have women, for example, as I'm building this platform, I'm thinking, I don't want it to be like Facebook or Instagram in the sense of being driven by engagement. I don't want people to come to the platform unless they actually have something to do. And when they come, I don't want them to get distracted by tons of stuff. I want them to be able to just navigate to where they want, to use their time well. Some people were asking me, so what are you going to do to bring more people to the platform? I said, actually, there's no pressure on doing that. It's just like, it's going to be there as a educational, something that's going to, and maybe a fundraising, all of these things that I'm working on. The fundraising part is proving very, very difficult, but we are going to work on that marketplace where women can share their products, services, and showcase their talent. I value people's time. I haven't watched a single Netflix or TV series or movie for over a year now. Like literally none, right?
Because I wish I could do the same. I really try to avoid it. Sometimes it's hard to avoid.
Right. And sometimes I go I go to post something on LinkedIn and I get it's just so hypnotic, just going to my homepage. It's like there's a ton of stuff that's like designed to bring your attention to so many different ways. And I think that's just so unhealthy, and we need to change that, right? That comes with long-term thinking and maybe thinking about profit in a different way. So maybe it may well be that maybe a woman will never make as much money as Jeff Bezos. They may create a much higher impact. I don't know. I mean, I don't know. Or there may be a way to make as much money more ethical way. I'm not saying that Amazon is not ethical, but there's been questionable practices in many of the large corporations, Amazon, Google, Facebook.
Sort of companies use that as a bully point, right, to show that they needed to sort of skirt the line on potentially some ethical issues so they could in fact grow their business. And I think that is a real struggle point. I think you look at market control, right? When you sort of look at how the stock markets across the world value sort of business as a whole, it's a short-term sort of thought process, right? There's very little, you know, look, we took a loss this quarter so that we can make, you know, money for the next 5 years.
Yeah.
You don't see a lot of, you don't see that happening that often.
Yeah.
Where maybe I think in a less connected age, that was potentially okay. You know, where reinvestment occurred at a deeper level. I think if you look at American business, we have definitely moved away from that.
Okay.
In some way, you know, also, I just look at sort of how the current state of the world has affected business, you know, benefit removal, right? You know, the rolling back of level of benefits for employees is something that's occurring globally, right? I think that is real, that causes some real issues. You know, one of the things I've been thinking about recently, and, you know, I've been trying to do as much reading as I can, you know, while not staring at potentially a screen all day long, you know, is how do we, you know, how has the sort of the state of the current world affected women in the workplace, right?
Yeah.
And you look at sort of three different pods, right? Pod number one is the younger employee who's really just getting started. Then you sort of maybe look at the middle level employee who does not have children. And then you look at a third group of women who have children, right? The Wall Street Journal is reporting that women and who have children have been negatively affected by the current state of the world, right? That is, there's really no way to argue against that, right?
And you mean by that COVID-19, right? So the
Yes, I mean the global pandemic,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
Right? And I, you know, one of the things that's important to me and sort of, you know, looking at this is we're going to have to come out of this at some point. And then what does our workplace look like? You know, I think we are moving to a more virtual world.
Yeah.
You know, businesses are not going to open the huge campuses that they used to. I think we have shown that we can work in a more segmented place.
Yeah.
That has benefits for women in the workplace. That has negatives for women in the workplace. And we have to think about what that really is going to look like long term, because there are just some people who are not physically going back to the office. There are some businesses where there is no office to go back to. And that's something that we're going to have to sort of build. I mean, we're both in our home offices right now, which really tells you a lot of what's been going on. You know, companies are going to have to think about reintegration, and they're going to have to think about more flexibility. That's something that we really, really need to focus in on. You know, I would hope that if you're at a company with a large human resources department, those discussions have already begun.
So you said reintegration, and what was the other thing?
We need to reintegrate, and we need to think about what flexibility looks like.
Okay.
Long term. That's a really deep conversation. It's just not, you know, it's not a nuts and bolts conversation.
When you think about, you know, like going back, considering that I wrote a book about the future of work, and mm-hmm. when you talk about reintegration, what are we going to reintegrate in? Because the shape of the world is changing, you know, like we are going towards a place where, you know, we are outsourcing our cognitive abilities to computers. And
yeah.
These are algorithms that are mostly being written by men. So I worry about, and I think about it a lot, especially for, like, I don't really know if what women are gonna have to bring to table, you know, in this world where
yeah.
it's so technologically driven. And mm-hmm. it's like, when I look at the people that I wanna hire, almost everything that I want to hire is technology roles. You know,
right.
I can't really think of, like, there's nobody in my team that doesn't have, you know, a very high level of, they may not be coders, but they're very good with a ton of different software. And they are, and there's like so much pressure on churning out content really quickly for our
yeah.
clients, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So, and increasingly, there are a lot of templates and a lot of, you know, prosumer and applications that are going to put people out of a business who have spent a long time, you know, learning the likes of Photoshop and you know, even Adobe After Effects, or even if they know it, it's like there are so many templates now, right? So it's just becoming more and more automated, and
yeah.
it's impacting, mm-hmm. of course, creativity.
Sure.
Because you're thinking, you know, I'm noticing even my creativity is being impacted sometimes, because I'm like, it may take me half a day of thinking about something to come up with a new idea, whereas I could go in and have a look at a number of templates and very quickly montage something, and you know, and the client will be happy because they have their think faster, but I'm using my mind, my brain less. So then I go and make up for that by learning other more complex things. But not everybody necessarily can or will do that. So I just wonder, in this world, what are women gonna have to bring to the table?
Well, let's break this down, because I think this is a few topics for us to discuss. So one of the things I think we're talking about is, what is the ethics of AI? What is the ethics of our computer technology? Let's table that for just a second, right? One of the things we've gotten away from in our digital world. Now, first of all, the both of us are not digital natives, right?
Yeah.
I remember a time before the internet. I remember the time where I was not connected to a cell phone at all times. The children of today, even high school students, they don't know that experience, right? Yeah. The ability, I remember when there was a time, you know, and I know this is making me sound quite old, but there was a time where I could not get the answer to something immediately, right?
Yeah.
You know, our level of interconnectedness has increased 100-fold in the last decade. You know, even when I was in college some years ago, there was no Wi-Fi. You know, you could barely get some baseline information. The library was still an extremely important place. Now, I mean, if you're a college student, a library is a nice place to go and study, but you're not necessarily looking through the books. And I think that has affected our ability in terms of strategy and in terms of creativity immensely. The ability to punch anything up at a moment is great on so many levels, right? The ability to, you know, just jump on Wikipedia and search for whatever you want, get any statistic immediately, is really a great thing. What we need to do is we need to strategize that, right? And which is something that some companies are doing and that we need to think about as a whole. So like in relation to your old business, if you're looking for a thought leader, right? Someone to think about everything, maybe that role is better suited for a woman, right? For someone who can look at the whole picture rather than sort of a male who maybe looking at a short-term sort of problem and looking to solve it. That is potentially one place where women can help us really build equality into our technology and business fields, right? What is our strategy? How does that fit into our technical infrastructure? You know, looking at, you know, I there has been a concerted effort and someone I worked for who is very important to me, Beverly Magda, who is a former CIO. More female CIOs is definitely a good thing for our business, right? So chief information officer growth and chief technology officer growth, I think, is really key. If you look at places like the Consumer Technology Association here in the United States, who have the largest trade show in the world, you know, their growth in sort of the female industry, I think, is incredibly important. Now, let's transition to ethics in computer technology and AI for a second. So, I mean, what I think is important is, you're right, the technology programs of tomorrow that really, and really even of today, that are producing algorithms on their own, that are making ethical decisions. You know, I every semester in my class, I get a question about, you know, what do we do about the AI empowered car, right? The smart car, the car that, you know, drives itself. And I have to talk to students about, how do we build a car that can think on its own, right? That has to make an ethical decision. Do I hit the driver next to me, or do I hit the person in the crosswalk? Those kinds of decisions are ones that we're really going to struggle with. And I think that we really need to spend some time thinking about, and it can't just be one sex who gets to make the decision as towards the ethics of that.
And that's my worry. That's my worry.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
That's a huge worry of mine. I have a lot of ethical worries about turning our sort of decision-making over to AI, because it removes, while the program is written by a human, right, on any level, you know, when you give the ability for something to calculate millions of split factor decisions in an instant, we're really going to struggle with a lot of ethical sort of norms towards that. There need to be deep discussions about how we implement that. Humans make errors on a number of levels, right? We have to really, really spend the time, I think, thinking a little bit on a larger level about who we want to be, right? You know, what do we want our society to be? If you look at what we were 30, 40 years ago, we've essentially erased part of our human history because of our level of interconnectedness. You know, I mean, look, I'm in the New York area, you're in London, we're having a video conversation. You know, this it would be unfathomable, you know, 20 years ago. So some of that has been sort of, we've sort of removed some of our own history. And we need to think about that as we move forward. I think one of the places where women can really help is sort of growing our sort of acumen as towards that we've removed some of the, our history from our sort of thinking.
I think the one of the issues here is like when we talk about we, when we say we, that we seems to be differently viewed by people who are in the forefront of building these technologies and the general public. And, you know, we are moving increasingly towards a society where it's like the top 1% and the bottom 99%. And I really think that we are going to see the disappearance of the middle classes. You know, we are increasingly going towards this kind of like, you know, the elite class and the underclass. The whole idea of it becomes, you know, a bit difficult to view there. And I remember reading in a book, I don't know, you probably are familiar with Max Tegmark, Professor Max Tegmark, who wrote the book Life 3.0. And he talks about MIT. So he talks about, in it, he says about this scenario where he's having dinner with Elon Musk and Larry Page and their wives and his wife, and they're like having this conversation where Larry Page tells Elon Musk, "You're being speciesist," and he's basically saying that if life is to go you know, outside of this planet, it's probably going to go in digital form. Silicon-based life is no less valuable than carbon-based life, right? So these guys are, but then there's the question of whether the silicon-based life is life, you know? So whether, you know, whether it has, so then we come to this whole concept of how do we define life? How do we define consciousness? And how do we define intelligence? And whether there is an inherent value in these concepts, as opposed to, say, for example, our AI driven, you know, as we become increasingly merged with these technologies. In the bigger picture of the universe and the, you know, bigger picture of evolution for people like Larry Page, in a sense, I get the feeling that for basically he's saying humans are not that important, basically, you know, in the bigger picture of the universe. And of course, that was very hard for me to digest at first. And then I went for long walks and I thought a lot about it. And I was like, I kind of see what he is saying and where he's coming from. And I don't, in principle, I don't disagree with him. But on the other hand, my concern, maybe because I'm a woman, but my concern is that this means the potential infliction of suffering on billions of people. And this is what worries me. That's why I think it's important to have women in that decision making, you know. So I see myself as a transition architect. I say, like, I'm not against this transition. I just think that we need to make this transition less painful and more humane, you know, and really think about how we are going to do it and achieve it. At what price? At you know, and why does it have to be so fast?
Yeah. So this is the first time I've ever been asked to wrestle with the ethics of global dynamics and sort of the universe as a whole. So thank you, Somi. I get to be get my Carl Sagan brain in play here. You know, one of the things that I think about as an ethicist in this viewpoint, you look at the United Nations reported that poverty globally is down, right? But the gap between sort of the wealthy and the sort of the poor is growing, as you described, right? So on some level, we're bringing up the level of what we would consider global poverty, right? But where the gap of the wealthiest humans on Earth is growing exponentially, right? There is no greater sort of example of this as what's going on with the pandemic, where billionaires are making even more
billions,
and right, their billions are growing at a rate which is really quite unfathomable. If you think about sort of human economic history, you know, one of the things that I think, you know, and that's something that's rooted in me is, you know, I work at two universities. I work at Georgetown University and Yeshiva University, right? Georgetown University is, we're trying to build a society for others. You know, Yeshiva is trying to build leadership in its students to help the world, right? So two really faith-based and two very different faiths, right? But, you know, ones that really are looking at how we help people who are not as in well-off as sort of us in the first world, right? We've seen a rise in the global population tremendously, you know, due to medicine, due to advancements in sort of settlement across, you know, at least the last 50 years, right? There has been no large global war that has occurred in, you know, in our lifetimes and has maybe even some of our parents' lifetimes, right? You know, one of the things that we need to think about now is how are we going to build up everybody at the same time, right? You know, how are we going to grow what should be a large and robust middle group? And I think that is a huge place for growth, right? And I think that that is the ability of men and women to work together in a stronger context. You know, women right now, if you look at how they manage sort of the global business, there just isn't enough power there yet, right? So that's sort of our development process is we got to get women in more powerful positions, whether it's at the corporate level or the government level to really grow that, right? Because I do think that there is the ability that many women, I don't want to classify all, many women do have, I think, the forethought to really help in that perspective, right? Maybe more than their male counterparts. I've experienced that sort of in my own career. You're talking to someone who's had a number of female bosses and managers over the years. And I have seen the ability for that larger sort of large scale thought process that really goes into what we need right now. So I think that's really, really, really quite important as we move forward. You know, I think that part of this is, you know, you talked about how fast we're going, right? I am a full proponent, and I will say it here, as stodgy and old as it made me look, we're moving too fast. We just don't have the ability to absorb what we're going through from a digital perspective in terms of our thought process, right?
Yeah, definitely.
It's going too fast. We have to slow the process down. You know, one of the things that's come as part of the pandemic, one of, you know, these buzz terms is doom scrolling, right? Through your social media feeds or through the news. You know, one of the things I think we have a negative opinion what's going on is we have more information than any human group ever, right? If you lived in, let's throw this out there. You lived in Southeast Asia, you know, 40 years ago, you might have had access to one foreign newspaper. Right. And then whatever the local newspaper is, you look at across the world, that was generalized sort of things. Right? The New York Times is printed in 150 plus countries. But, you know, there's not that there wasn't the kind of access there is today. We are on information overload all of the time. I don't need to be an expert in psychology to tell you that because I know I'm experiencing it. Right.
Yeah.
That is something that we. You know, we need to slow down. You know, one of the things that I rail upon in my own life is the number of emails that I get in a day, right? If you look at the increase and if then I look at sort of my own students, they're shutting out email, right? The next generation will be the first generation who doesn't primarily use email on some level because we've destroyed it on some level. We've taken it and we've maximized it so much that people don't want to read it anymore. People don't want to go through it.
Yeah.
And I think that is, you know, you look at, I always find things on social media, people posting, you know, they have 150,000 unread emails, right?
Yeah.
You know, I mean, that's an incredible number.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, if you had 150,000 unread letters, you know, that'd be something.
It's crazy.
You know, it's crazy, right? You couldn't even fathom that.
Yeah. And so of course, everybody who writes to you thinks that they are the only one and they expect
sure.
that.
So,
you know.
Sure.
Yeah.
We have moved too quickly in that regard. There need to be better tools.
Yes.
You know, you want to talk about a place for women to really grow in terms of an entrepreneurial field. Don't make us faster. Make us slower.
Well, you know, I think it's not going to happen. I think that they're not going to, yeah, right. I don't think people, you know, it's not in the interest of big technology firms to make it slower. So that's not going to happen. So what's the next solution is for us to maybe speed up our processing power. And one way of doing that is more technology, you know, like, sure. Right? Like think about, you know, what companies like Neuralink are doing, right? They're trying to see that the truth is this, like there's a bunch of old guys, a bunch of old white guys, you know, that are in their 50s and 60s and then 70s, and they just don't want to die, right? You know, like there's like Ray Kurzweil, he's like 72 years old, you know, he's like at Google, you know, he's even written a book about longevity. They just don't want to die. So they're going to push, right? They're going to push the wolf, you know, to a point of singularity, as Ray Kurzweil puts it, you know, to perhaps by some miracle, they can live forever or much longer, right? Sure. So that's really part of what's happening. And the truth is, it's in the interest of these large corporations to pursue this dream of, you know, longevity. And look, and on the one hand, you know, like I said, you know, how I said about how I feel about what Larry Page said, I don't disagree with him. And I would, you know, I don't necessarily want to die, not because I hate dying, but because I just want to stick around and see what's going to happen. It's so fascinating.
Exactly, what's going
to
happen next?
Right? It's a very interesting time to live in. So so I'm interested, like, if I could connect my brain to some kind of, you know, electrical device that's going to make me a lot more, you know, intelligent and you know, super smart, and I can experience ways of being and or like thoughts or processing power that I couldn't do otherwise, I'd be up for it. You know, I'm all up for it. But am I up for it at the expense of, you know, billions of people being left with no purpose? Sure. And no, you know, then no, you know, then in that case, no. But like, how many people think in that terms, you know? So I think we are kind of in, you know, I don't know how to put it, but without sounding like too dramatic, but it's kind of like a mental, potentially, the genocide that we experienced throughout World War, you know, like sure. The Holocaust. It's kind of like a mental Holocaust by setting, you know, by putting potentially billions of people or hundreds of millions of people in a position of being irrelevant.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's two things that we're sort of talking about here, right? Is like, what technology do we need to really, which technology is next that's going to help us grow, right? I'm a glasses wearer, obviously, and I've worn a pair of Google glasses before, and I thought that it was a great piece of technology, right? I am looking forward to the day where my glasses are a computer, okay? As someone who, you know, struggles to see things. And also, you know, doesn't want to have to look down at a screen all the time. You know, the ability for me to have some microprocessor within my glasses and for me to have a display that either helps my sight or helps me process, I'm 100% on board for. And obviously there's huge ethical implications with that, which is why the Google Glass project was shut down, right? I think that is a project that I'm fully for because it's in my best interest, right? As someone who, you know, has worn glasses for 25 plus years. One of the things that I think is really interesting and what you're saying is I look at the issues of climate change and I also look at what's going on with the pandemic. You know, from an ethical perspective, we've put people at risk, okay? Like we've put not just a few, we've put millions of people and that number is ever growing, right? We put them a huge amounts of risk in terms of their food source, in terms of water, in terms of the ability for a storm to wipe out a village or something, another natural occurrence to really upend their life. We're doing that calculus, okay? That is something that we have not really factored in to our sort of our ethical calculus yet. We're putting these people at risk and we don't seem to care, or they're just being written off. And, you know, one of the things that I struggle with, you know, is, you know, where is that line? You know, where does the line between, you know, we need to obviously, you know, we need to have a sort of a first world, you know, that is robust. right? And that has an economy that sort of powers the rest of the world versus, you know, look, we've got, you know, millions of people potentially at risk to lose their homes and livelihood and potential lives because of some of the things that we haven't put into place. You know, you look at how the pandemic has affected global carbon emissions, right? Well, global carbon emissions are at the lowest point they've been in for as long as we've been tracking it, essentially. You know, and I think that's an interesting little piece of something we need to think about. You know, one of the things I think, if you think about, you know, politics, government, and for the ability for us to come together, and you sort of look at the Paris Climate Accords, there has to be leadership now. We have run past the point of where we can just put this on the back burner. Leadership is really needed. You know, one of the things leaders needs are tools, right? If you're looking for tool set building, this is your prime time. This is where those things are really important. You know, you've talked a little bit about Elon Musk, you know, and obviously, look, he owns Tesla, right, which is a green car company. And he also owns SpaceX, which is apparently a cleaner way for us to get out of our own atmosphere. So, you know, those kinds of things are a step in the right direction. You know, how do we facilitate that along with the ability for choice? You know, the last thing that I want is, you know, there's only one green company, right? There's only one company that provides the green solution. Let's get some entrepreneurs out there. Yeah. You know, let's build that space.
Definitely. I don't think there is a better place to bring this conversation to an end because on a positive note. And yeah, let's do that. And that's why we are doing all of this. And sure. Hopefully we will we'll be able to bring more women into these fields and bring and encourage more women to actually start thinking about these issues and really getting involved in the conversation. You know, it just pains me when I see that the social media algorithms are designed to just focus on women's looks and like encouraging women to, it's like, I really wish that, you know, it was more focused on, and that's why I'm trying to build my own platform, is like get women exposed to things that maybe they wouldn't be exposed to otherwise.
I mean, we haven't really mentioned this term yet, STEM fields, right?
Yes.
Science, technology, engineering, and mathematics, right? You know, one of the things, and this is not my idea, but one of the ideas that I've been hearing over and over again that I'm hoping that we can do, and what we need to do really at a grammar school level, right? Across the board. So, you know, I'm talking about students 16 and younger, is, you know, when there was a space race going on, and I'm going to speak from an American perspective, there was a space race going on. Kids wanted to go into rocket dynamics, right? They wanted to become rocket scientists. You know, look, we're going through a global pandemic where we have a virus that's killed millions of people now, and many millions are still sick and struggling. You know, I'm hoping that this moment will allow us to have sort of a STEM revolution within our children, right? Yeah. I want to make the bad germs go away. I want us to solve those. I want children to think, look, I want to become a chemist so that we don't have this again, right? Or I want to become a technologist to build an air ventilation system that's both green and also can, you know, make mommy and daddy's office open. You know, that we need that kind of development. We need that kind of push in the right direction. I think that sometimes we're often working against that because of how we've set up our technology systems. You know, as someone who spends a ton of time, you know, thinking about global ethical problems, you know, we need to find some level of balance with that. You know, look, I'm not saying that all technology is bad or all social media is bad or everything that we're doing is wrong. I think we're doing a lot right. A key thing in terms of making ethical decisions is finding the proper balance, and equilibrium sometimes is off.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, look, that's our space, right? Women of college age, you know, the time for growth and development is now. You know, one of the things we haven't talked about is at a college level, this is the greatest time for growth. There's the greatest number of opportunity for women there has ever been, right? Every day it grows a little bit, right? And that's something I want us to maybe our final point here today is this is a time for great opportunity. The opportunity grows. Use the opportunities now because they didn't exist when maybe me and you were a little bit younger.
Yeah, absolutely, definitely. They were not there, and that's why it's my life mission to try and make sure when I'm dying that the future generations, you know, have those opportunities. And it may, you know, in my generation we may not have a female equivalent of those 10 founders that we right. talked about, but we may do. Who knows? You know.
We might.
Yeah, and I'm definitely gonna make a run for it, you know. But if I don't make it, at least if I don't get to the star, at least I will have gotten to the moon, and then hopefully I'll be a stepping stone for other women to get, you know. So that's the idea.
I think that's a great way to look at it.
Yeah,
that's a
definitely. Great way to look yeah, at it. Like because to me, you know, the destination. There's a Persian little rhyme. It's a nursery rhyme. It's I love it, and I'm gonna end on that. It's like I'll say the Persian of it for people who understand Persian, and then I'll say the translation. It says, رسیدیم و رسیدیم کاش که نمی رسیدیم تو را بودیم خوش بودیم سوار لاک پشت بودیم. Means that we've arrived. I wish we hadn't arrived. We were so happy on the way, and we were sitting on the back of a turtle. You know, so that's like kind of putting that mindset of appreciating the journey. You know, I always think of myself as like an Olympic athlete. You know, you're like, I'm training for the race of my life, you know. So that destination is secondary, and it's like, it's a moment, yes. right? So whereas if you can't enjoy every second of the way and the training and the pain, most of your life is gone. Because even if you win, you know, you've basically spent most of your time in not enjoying, right, the pain. So you've got
Absolutely.
To become, you know, you've got to become friends with the pain. You know, we need more women getting into that.
Yes.
Thank you so much, Joshua. That was great.
So, I mean, this was a pleasure. I really enjoyed spending some time with you today and really chatting. And I hope we will continue these conversations throughout the years.
Absolutely. I'm sure we will. And I'm sure we will have you on the panel again and on the podcast again. Thank you.
Thank you, Somi.
I hope you enjoyed this conversation with Joshua Meredith. As always, I want to leave you with the introduction to another awesome woman, this time in the history of computing. Her name is Ada Lovelace. She was the first person to recognize that an analytical engine could have universality. Another way of saying that she realized that a computer could be used for much more than just doing arithmetic calculations, and that it could also process language, music, and so much more. Although back then, they didn't call it a computer. She also published the first algorithm intended to be carried out by such a machine, making her one of the first ever computer programmers. Her story is an important part of the history of computer science. If you enjoyed this podcast, please subscribe on iTunes or Spotify and YouTube, or connect with me on LinkedIn, Twitter, or Instagram.